Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today is Daniel McAdams, our co-host. Daniel, good morning. Good to see you.
How are you this morning, Dr. Paul?
I'm doing well today, and thought we'd talk a little bit about NATO. NATO was in the news yesterday and last couple of days, and Trump went over and tried to straighten them out. He had a little meeting there, but it seems like a few people in Washington didn't like what he was saying or the way he was saying it. So quickly, in order to express their disapproval of the Trump diplomacy, the House and the Senate rushed to pass some resolutions, and overwhelmingly, it won't be too much of a surprise to you, but overwhelmingly, they supported the notion that we should be loyal supporters and financiers of NATO. We need NATO. It's the road to peace because they have been so outstandingly successful over the years, and when Trump makes the suggestion, you guys ought to pay your own way, they get hysterical. Of course, he also throws in there, maybe we ought to get out, too. But truth is I think getting out is a threat to him. He vacillates a bit, and I don't think that's his goal. But, you know, the way he negotiates, he throws out the threats, and they act immediately. But it's surprising, within minutes. And it wasn't just a couple of Democrats, a couple of Republicans. It was the Congress. It was the establishment. It was the military-industrial complex and everything else. Just overwhelming. There were only two votes in opposition in the Senate, and I think it was, 22 in the House. This is just super support for internationalism, total belief in the role of NATO as a preserver of the peace. And over the years, I haven't quite seen it that way, and I think that right now is a good time to reassess it. But I believe that if a person advocates a non-interventionist position and not internationalism rather than individual sovereignty and a working for peace in the matter that we talk about, you know, we're on the short end of the stick. But the big question is, are we really as bad off as those votes reflected, or are those votes reflecting what can be done by the lobbyists when the people are sleeping?
Yeah, that's a good point. And the bill is H.R. 676, the NATO Support Act. And as you point, there was a companion bill in the Senate, a little bit different, but a companion bill that passed overwhelmingly. But I think it's significant that this is the new House of Representatives. The Democrats took over control of the House. And what are one of the first pieces of legislation they take up? Is it dealing with the health care issues that they're talking about, domestic spending, all of these? No. It's the first thing they take up is a vote declaring our support for NATO. 30 years this year, 30 years ago the Cold War ended. The purpose for NATO started in 1949, ended 30 years ago today. And here are the House Democrats taking up the war cudgel. And why are they doing it? They're only doing it to beat Trump over the head, because Trump has suggested a few times, and as you point out, his heart may not be in it, suggested that NATO is not everything that's cracked up to be.
Well, that's for sure. It'd be interesting to have a real honest poll by the American people. But I think it's something the American people don't think about very much, and they don't quite understand the commitment that has been made. But the way the House version, how it works, is they deny funding. It's interesting. The technicality is that they're going to deny funding for Trump to move in the direction of getting out of NATO, which is sort of a complex way, because there's sort of a debate that's been going on. How much authority does the president have? I would I don't think even in the treaties there's no obligation, even under Article 5, for people to say, when NATO acts, or even if the UN act, that we have to do it, do whatever they say. So there is some prerogatives that the president has, but when it comes to funding and all and literally getting out, I guess there's not an explicit route for getting out of NATO, but there should be an explicit route for not getting involved, and that's the Constitution.
Yeah, and it is a technicality, denying funds to withdraw from NATO. I think that the piece of legislation is just mere symbolism. It's just used as a political attack against the president, because really, if you put it in action, I don't think it could be carried out the way it's written. And I think Congress knows that, because there's a sense of Congress within the bill that Goldwater versus Carter is not controlling legal precedent with respect to U.S. withdrawal from a treaty. So you go back and look that one up. 1979, President Carter was trying to pull the U.S. out of a defense treaty unilaterally as the president, as executive, and it was challenged, and it went up to the Supreme Court. This is what the Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to hear this because this is not a constitutional issue. This is a political fight between the president and Congress. So they refused to hear it, and subsequently, President Bush in 2002 pulled the U.S. out of the ABM treaty without Congress's involvement. So it is certainly far from clear whether this piece of legislation would carry any weight constitutionally.
Well, I think it'd be much easier if we just didn't get involved in these treaties, and many of them do make commitments. And in some ways, I've seen some treaties, because it's so-called said that treaties become the law of the land, but that has to be defined too as well, because you literally can't have a treaty and give up your entire constitution. So I think when it violates the constitution, that it should be challenged, and we should stay out of out of so many. But I think what has happened over the years is that I've heard the complaint about we pay too much. And I think my whole view of NATO has changed over the years, because for a long time, I thought it was only, you know, sort of like the Trump position. We're getting stuck with the bill. We're paying the bill, and we don't have anything to say about it. But I still think we're getting stuck with the bill. But I see it as that's our payment to be the boss.
Yeah.
Because if we need support, NATO doesn't go to war. The United States goes to war, and then they get the rubber stamped by these countries. Then they come in and give us approval. You know, you could Libya and Afghanistan and Iraq, and we always get this approval. So we pay to be the boss. So in some ways, it's an investment. And some people say, yeah, that means we have a control. I imagine there's a lot of American people say, well, that's good, Ron. Why are you doing that? We want to be the boss. But if it were worthwhile to have NATO, maybe. But I just don't see essentially anything worthwhile. Conversation and talking to people and even some of the treaties that exist, we defend in many ways about, you know, maybe denuclearization and things like that. But it's something that we're in charge. Money's involved. Cutting money's probably the big deal here, and they want more money. There was one part of this vote that I thought was interesting, because it implied more spending, and you know who gets to spend the money.
Yeah.
you know where it goes. But it said that there are in firm support for NATO and its mutual defense clause for Montenegro accession. And said, all of a sudden, that's important. They put this in here at the height of this crisis for robust, and that's in quote, robust U.S. funding for the European a deterrence initiative, and for the goal that each member spend at least 2%, which is a bunch of silliness. But it's spending. I think that one initiative to start off with, they need $8 or $9 billion.
Yeah.
But you know, if we're the boss and we're running the show, and if they get somebody to tone down Trump's challenges, oh my, it's smooth sailing. But it'll be smooth sailing. They'll still get the money. They're still going to get the weapons. Military-industrial complex will win, but they're going to lose in the end, because this type of thing, draining an economy and just paying for our needs through debt and inflation, it runs out of steam and is starting to run out of steam. So this whole thing won't work. But it for now, this is working, and guess what? Certain people make money, and right now, in this issue, it's those who are in the arms manufacturing business.
Yeah, for sure, and not only that. But in response to the thing you said earlier, that, oh, people would say, hey, that's good, Ron, we're in charge. My question would be, well, who's we? You know,
yeah.
Who's the we that you're talking about? It's not us. It's not folks like us. It's not folks who work for a living. It's people in very high-paid jobs. Working in policy, working in the military industry. But, you know, the debate in Congress was really interesting. You know, Elliot Engel, you remember him from the Foreign Affairs Committee. Very, very warmonger. I would call him a left neocon. Certainly a hawk. Well, he was quoted talking about this piece of legislation. It's like the guy is in a time warp. All of a sudden, we're in the middle of 1953 or something. He said, splintering the NATO alliance is one of Putin's top goals. You know, and this is why we got to pass this bill, as if the Soviet Union is breathing down our neck. So my question when I read that, how does he know that? How does he know that that's one of Putin's top goals? He doesn't. He made it up. He's making it up. He's just making it up out of thin air. I would actually say if Putin really wanted to splinter things and really wanted to wrong foot the U.S., he'd be saying, go NATO, more NATO, spend more, do more, go everywhere, you know. So he'd want to keep us in NATO and keep us footing the bill, because that, more than anything else, will splinter us, make us go bankrupt.
You know, I've often mentioned the fact that a senator from 1949 at this time, after he lost the election, the presidential election, He was in the Senate, but he made a speech on NATO, and he took a position that being opposed to NATO. And I thought, well, that's pretty good, because I thought everybody would want to be in NATO. World War II is just ending, and we have to be strong and prevent the next war from occurring. But he had several reasons why he opposed it. And his first one that he lists was it would be an open-ended commitment to go to the rescue of almost any of those 29 countries. Now there's 29 countries, because most people think that Article 5 is absolute and that we have to go. But there is a subtle commitment. You know, it's mutual. It's always a mutual defense treaty, and it has nothing to do with it. It has them joining us, obeying us, being part of our empire, and they listen to us, and we'll pay the bills. And that's what's been going on. But he also mentioned at the time, and this is what Trump's talking about, and I thought about early on, and there's a cost to this. Why do we pay more than the rest of them? And we do, proportionately speaking, we pay more. So that is an issue, and it can grab some people. Even the conservative hawks might say that's true. They all can argue, oh, yeah, they should, countries should work up to the point of paying 2% of their GDP and put it into militarism and you know, finance all these organizations like NATO. But then he had another one, which I found rather astounding, that he says the way this is going to operate is that we will surround Russia with our bases and be very provocative toward Russia. Now, that's pretty astute, because immediately, and even though Jimmy Baker and Reagan, you know, made these promises at the time when we were starting to set up our defenses, we said we're going to stay a certain distance away from the Russian border, which we did not follow through with our promises. And I think that was essentially in writing. People know they said that. Yeah. And Russia has an argument about that. Look at what you're doing to us. But I thought it was very astute for Taft to say, watch out, you're going to just do it all over again. But see, we assume that it'd be good not to have a Cold War, hot war or a Cold War, but this wouldn't be the people who like NATO, because their goal is to have a Cold War. Yeah. That's what they want. A Cold War is much better. Nobody dies, you know, this sort of thing. But nobody died between 1949 and 1990. Like how many wars were fought in the Cold War?
But that's astute from Taft, because he was not dealing with Russia, democratic Russia.
No.
He was dealing with the Soviet Union, which had been certainly in the 40s expansionist to a degree, if you talk about Central and Eastern Europe. So even dealing with a Soviet Union that you could certainly say was a threat ideologically and in other ways, he still didn't want to go out to its borders. And now it's 30 years after the Cold War, and these guys want to go back up to the borders. So, and you talked about Article 5, and the legislation does invoke it, but I don't think people realize this, Dr. Paul, that this is not an obligation to go to war. Article 5 just simply says if one of the members is attacked, other members will assist the attacked party by taking such actions as it deems necessary, including the use of force, but not obligated to use of force. It invokes Article 51 of the UN Charter, and it also really is a stopgap. The whole Article 5 is a stopgap until the UN Security Council can get involved. It's an emergency issue, and it says it in the NATO treaty. So the whole idea that this is a standalone obligation, that we're going to have a nuclear war with Russia if a Latvian, you know, gets his toe stubbed, you know, on a Russian rock or something, is totally a fallacy.
And I'd like to go ahead and close with talking a little bit about what I talk about frequently, and that is how Democrats and Republicans come together. And once again, this has to be a big issue for the establishment, a big issue for the military-industrial complex, a big issue for our empire, because believe me, they came together rather quickly in spite of all that hate and arguing that they go through on Russiagate and the whole works. But boy, they came together. We have to be on record. We love NATO, and we have to support it, and we don't want to work toward a peaceful solution without the military threat that we can pose with NATO. But it's remarkable, but it shouldn't surprise us that the big issues get directions from outside the Congress in many ways, and the leadership goes along with it. And lo and behold, look at those votes. You know, whether it's the House or the Senate, they're all very supportive of NATO and the continuation of a policy which is deeply flawed. I mean, we are not less safe because of NATO. We're more endangered. Just think of what's happened under NATO. You know, I think this assumption that we've had some peaceful benefits from NATO, I don't think anybody's ever really studied that objectively, because I don't quite see that. I just don't think that they gave us peace and prosperity because of NATO. What happened was in spite of them. But this might be a turning point for us on our foreign policy. We're losing credibility. It's turning on us. We've overused sanctions, and we've isolated ourselves, and we've also conditioned ourselves to be really, really deeply in debt, and the monetary system's a mess. So this might be a wonderful opportunity for us to present the case for non-intervention. But we have to show that non-interventionism contributed to the needless war and the killing and drained the wealth from the people, and also contributed significantly to the maldistribution of wealth in this country. The wealthy get wealthy and the poor get poorer. The middle class gets wiped out, which has nothing to do with too much freedom or too much of a sound currency. It has to do with a system that is deeply flawed, and many people say, oh, that's capitalism. Then they come along and they say, ah, the answer is socialism. I'll tell you what. If we fall into accepting that argument, believe me, substituting what we have today with outright militant socialism, believe me, we're in for some very tough times. But I don't think it has to be that way. I just think we have to reach the people, especially the young people, and get them to realize that liberty is really a blessing, and that's what we have to support. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today to the Liberty Report. Please come back soon.